Welcome from me, Noel Debien, sitting in for Andrew West. Well, last Saturday, one man in particular emerged out of the chaos in northern Iraq. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIL, the self-proclaimed Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. Well, the Levant, if you understand it, could mean Jordan, Syria, Israel, parts of Egypt, even parts of Turkey. So it's a big claim. Al-Baghdadi claiming to be the new caliph and calling all Muslims around the world to move to his new Sunni Muslim stronghold. You may have seen that video posted on Saturday of al-Baghdadi addressing men attending a mosque in Mosul, Iraq's largest northern city. That's the mosque where he executed its Sunni imam, Mosul Muhammad al-Mansuri, along with 13 other Sunni religious leaders. Not hard line enough for al-Baghdadi and ISIL. In his sermon, he called on all Muslims to obey him. Some Australians have already by joining the armed struggle in Syria and Iraq. To shed some light on what lies behind the terrible conflict during this Ramadan month, Dr. Samina Yasmeen, Professor of Political Science and International Relations at UWA, is in our Perth studios. Dr. Samin, ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, it cut its teeth in the Syrian war. Australians have joined them. Foreign Minister Julie Bishop said perhaps 150. Melbourne-born Musa Sarantonio certainly says he's there because he tweeted it. Last week, Attorney General George Brandis invited a group of senior imams to Canberra, aiming to stop more Australians from going there. In the UK, we hear reports of 400 imams calling on British Muslims to refrain. Could imams have a real influence in your view?
I think it depends on the situation, but there is a clear difference between the Muslim migration and the Muslim demography in Australia compared to countries like Britain, Canada and America. A lot of diversity within Australia in the Muslim community.
76 language groups, I think I last counted.
Exactly, yeah. And even the number of years that Muslims have lived in Britain is a lot longer than the number of years that they have lived in Australia. Having said that, how do we see the role of imams? I think imams can tell other people who have not thought about engaging in jihad or leaving Australia to go elsewhere and remind them of their duty as a minority religious community living in Australia as citizens. But beyond that, there's a limit. And that is because people who get mobilized to go and participate in jihadi activities, they don't necessarily engage in social activities where the messenger is very clearly articulating the message of jihad in a public forum where they can pick it up and then they can go. So given that, if imams are not mobilizing people openly to go and fight jihad, then getting them to counter the jihadi message is, I think, expecting too much. Even if they're willing to give that message, there is always the danger that those who are not going to listen to these messages would go underground, and it would also confirm to them that if they do want to engage in these activities, they have to stay away from these imams. I'm not sure if just relying on imams is the answer to countering this tendency to go and participate in what is not homegrown terrorism, but outbound terrorism.
There is another strategy in Britain I'm aware of that's engaged Muslim women to encourage young men not to go to Syria and Iraq. Could that be an effective strategy, you think, through mothers and sisters and wives?
I think that would be actually a better strategy. And if we look at the way jihadi groups have mobilized young people to engage in jihad, they've actually used women as the mobilizers. And so if we want to counter that, we could rely on women as nurturers within the family spheres to give an idea that it is not Islamic to go and kill people indiscriminately in this so-called jihad, and give people the idea, what does it really mean to be a Muslim in today's world?
historically, I'm aware that the caliphates, like the Ottomans and the Umayyads, they officially protected religious minorities like Christians and Jews. But we've now have reports that the Imam of Mosul, Muhammad al-Mansuri himself, a Sunni Muslim imam, has been executed by ISIL, along with 12 other Sunni imams who are not hardline enough. Now, Email Shimon Nona, the Chaldean Archbishop, says thousands of Christians have left Mosul. He says churches have not had mass there since ISIL's takeover. How do events like these reflect on Baghdadi's claims to be the caliph?
Let me first of all look at his action, and I think they're anything but Islamic. They really grow out of this belief that anyone who provides a notion of what it means to be a Muslim and has weapons to support it can go to the extent of being as barbaric as he has been and as he has encouraged his own group members and the followers. Once somebody is convinced of the authenticity of their idea of Islamic notions and identity, and if they have weapons, they engage in completely barbaric acts.
And more specifically on the claim to be a caliph, how would you evaluate that in light of the way he's been behaving?
Well, the whole notion of caliph really is so sophisticated, and it's historically based that for anyone to get up and claim that he's a caliph really needs to be laughed at. To give you a sense of how the whole institution of caliphate evolved, it really evolved after Prophet Muhammad passed away and the question of succession engaged as to who should be the caliph. Now, among the Shias and the Sunnis, the division existed because some argued that it was in the family line and so they supported Ali to be the next leader, and others argued that Abu Bakr, Umar and Uthman should be. But essentially, based on that experience, the first four caliphs, there's a relatively general consensus that caliphs are not vice-regents of Allah because that would give them the same status as prophets. The next most accepted position is that caliphs are the vice-regents of the prophets. So they carry the message and the activities and actions that Prophet Muhammad established while he ruled Medina as the Muslim leader. There are others who argue that Muslim community is really the whole basis for this caliphate, and so caliphs are the vice-regents of the Muslim community. So the Muslim community's rights and responsibilities in some ways even override the caliph's opinions. Given that, the question is that which aspect of caliphate is he assuming to be appropriate for him?
So in effect, you're arguing that among Muslims, there is some consensus that the ummah or the community is the source of the appointment and, I suppose, authority of a caliph. There's another which sees it as a much more prophetic role falling in the line of Muhammad himself, which would have more control from the centre. What is al-Baghdadi looking for? What is he asking for?
Well, what Baghdadi is claiming is that he is the vice-regent in the same tradition as the first four righteous caliphs. He doesn't say it in so many words, but that's the message that he communicates. And because there's this understanding that caliph can either be chosen by people or a caliph can be nominated by the preceding caliph, what he has employed is two different strands of logic. One is that he's a vice-regent of prophet. So therefore, he has a right to establish the Islamic State along the lines that he thinks Prophet Muhammad established. Secondly, which I find very interesting, is that he points out that he carries over from where Osama bin Laden lived, and he refers to Osama bin Laden as Sheikh. So in that sense, what he's implying is that Osama bin Laden really had a dream for establishing caliphate, and Zawahiri, after Osama bin Laden's assassination, has really not picked up that message. But because the responsibility was given to al-Baghdadi, he has put that into practice. So he's meeting two criteria. One is that he is committed to prophetic message, quote-unquote, according to his understanding. And second, he has been nominated. Because there is also this body of knowledge which came about later on in Islamic history, that you could be a caliph purely because you have established control by using force.
These are like the Umayyads or the Ottomans that we knew even until last century. I think it was abolished finally around 1924 by Kemal Ataturk. That's what we knew even up to most recently, isn't it?
Exactly. Now, that tradition, what he's done is that he's revived that. But the interesting bit is that Muslims actually never were able to agree among themselves once the caliphate was abolished as to who should rule this caliphate. What Baghdadi is doing is that he is picking up those ambitions, which we also see in the discussion of caliphate by Hizb ut-Tahrir. And he says that having occupied a land, he has taken on the right and the responsibility to establish an Islamic state along the prophetic tradition.
He's asking for more than the Ottomans had, though, isn't he?
Oh, yes, but that's because the way Ottomans took over the mantle of being the caliphs was very different. And only gradually, once they had occupied the territory where a caliph was existing, that they finally decided that it
would we're the caliphs. We've gone far enough. We are now the caliphs. Well, can I ask you, Imam yes. Fazl Abdul Rauf, of course, who's working on the Cordoba Initiative, something you know well about, he's been studying the Islamic Rule of Law Index. This is the thing which decides or constitutes what a good Islamic state is. Mm-hmm. And he says that determining the genuineness of any claim by this al-Baghdadi to be caliph is virtually beyond Islamic jurisprudence at this point because it's just not achievable. Nobody could test it. Nobody could agree. Is he right, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Because I think the phenomena that we are observing at the moment is one where somebody has used force, power, exploited the inability of the Syrian government to respond appropriately to what we referred to in the past as Arab Spring, and also the divisions within the opposition that fought against Bashar al-Assad and extended his position in and control in Iraq as well. Given the fact that he has come to power by use of force and not through a process that somebody could actually say that there was a state that was converted into some sort of an Islamic state and then the leader took on the mantle of being the caliph, all we can say is that this is a rogue state and somehow the head of the state has decided to identify himself as caliph and that doesn't give him the right.
What does this mean for Christians and Muslims? Are we going to actually see an entirely Muslim area, for example? Will Christians simply need to move, be practical? Will Shiites simply need to move to be practical? Is that what's happening here?
I think if we look at the maps that al-Baghdadi and ISIL has published, their idea is not to remain limited to the area that they've already occupied, but extend their power both in the East, in the West, and even in Europe. And so whether you are there or not, even if you move out of that area, they're coming to get you. Now, what does that mean for people living there? I think given the fact that they have a very particular idea of what Islam is all about, which has grown out of really a whole lot of instability, and I would argue strongly, lack of knowledge about Islamic principles, they're likely to apply their principles with the same vengeance that we saw in Afghanistan when Taliban were in power. In fact, it could even get worse than that. So it doesn't matter whether you're Shia, Sunni, or whether you're Christian, Jew, or Muslim, or any other religion, their understanding of an Islamic state, I think, poses a threat to everyone who does not agree with their idea of Islam. So human rights violations, they will increase, which, if we go into this very strict Islamic principles, is extremely un-Islamic. Because very logically speaking, a caliphate, let's for the sake of argument, we think that it is a caliphate, has a history of providing opportunities for not just its Muslim citizens, but also people of other religions.
The people of the book, the Christians and the Jews.
Mm. Exactly. And in fact, if we look at historical empires, a lot of literature was brought into the Muslim thinking because there were people who were able to translate them and they were of different religious backgrounds. So the caliphate, if it was established along really strict Islamic lines, would ensure that everybody is treated fairly, humanely, irrespective of their religious background. I don't see that happening here. I think this is a group that has grown out of misunderstanding of Islamic knowledge, but has grown out of access to power, due to instability in the region and in these countries, and has managed to run its course in a way that certainly is posing a threat. We could see some similarity with Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, because small, uncontrollable group, gradually, because the state can't manage, they extend their influence, and then they can pose a threat.
Dr. Samina Yasmeen, also a director of the Centre for Muslim States and Societies at the University of Western Australia. You're with me, Noel Debien, standing in for Andrew West on the Religion and Ethics Report. Last year, The Economist magazine said that $22.3 trillion was hidden from governments using illegal or questionable tax havens. Australia's Treasurer, Joe Hockey, wants to put international tax avoidance and profit shifting by multinational companies on the agenda of the G20 for its Brisbane meeting in November. But for the developing world, the situation is much worse. The Open Society Foundation has calculated that Africa loses twice as much in tax revenue as it receives in foreign aid. Christian Aid is another organisation on the case of international tax dodging. For more than a decade, one of its leaders, the Kenyan economist Dr. Deraje Alamehu, has been in Australia lobbying the federal government ahead of the G20. Dr. Alamehu is also chairman of the Global Alliance for Tax Justice. He's been speaking with Andrew West.
For every $1 coming in to Africa, $3 leave the continent in the form of illicit financial flows, which is mostly driven by tax dodging. And another organization called the Global Financial Integrity found out from the illicit flows coming out of Africa, 60% happens through commercial transactions. Corruption has a maximum of 10% share in it. So the bulk of resource flows from Africa are through commercial activities of multinational companies and wealthy individuals.
Well, I think one of your documents makes the case that this is a moral issue. Tell us why it's a moral issue.
Just imagine, in some continent you might have not been to, people die of hunger and you steal their rightful income through tax dodging by hiring lawyers, by using secrecy jurisdictions. Is it not morally questionable if you get rich at the cost of others?
Well, let's talk about some of the things that you are lobbying the G20 to look at when it meets in Australia later this year. You want something called beneficial ownership transparency. What's that about?
Because for tax reasons, there are lots of fake or shell companies registered in many secrecy jurisdictions. Just to give you an idea, on the British Virgin Islands, there are 34 companies registered per inhabitant. There are more companies registered than inhabitants. Barack Obama was talking about a building in Cayman Islands, which houses 12,000 companies from the US.
So, I don't think it's a very big building either.
That's exactly it. So now what happens is, according to OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, 60% of commercial transactions globally take place between affiliates of the same companies. It is an intra-company trade. And just imagine when it is possible to have so many shell companies registered somewhere. Transactions which are intra-industry transactions can be made appear as transactions between different entities. So there is a very high possibility of manipulating internal transactions and make profits appear where taxes are not due or are low or non-existent, or make costs rise in jurisdictions where there is normal tax rate to pay. Just a small point is, you know, profit is always equal to sales minus costs. If you have two jurisdictions with different tax rates, it is always advantageous for tax dodging to make costs as high as possible in countries where you have to pay normal taxes, and to make sales as high as possible in countries where you have to pay no tax at all or very limited. So that is why, for example, the Isle of Jersey between the UK and France is the biggest banana exporter to Western Europe, although they don't draw a tree of banana.
Just citing that figure that you mentioned before, 60% of international transactions being within the one company, would it be preferable then for us to have companies with more unified structures so that they couldn't basically chop their companies up into these tiny little entities?
You know, one of the asks of the international tax justice movement is to have country-by-country reporting, to have beneficial ownership known, so that we can tell that profits declared are compatible with economic activities happening in a certain locality. In the final analysis, tax systems can work. In the long run, an economy can survive only if economic activities correspond to the tax paid. And that's the only way an economy can exist in the long run. Tax is not a cost. It is a contribution you make to live as human beings in a humane society.
That's Andrew West speaking with Kenyan economist Deraje Alemayehu of Christian Aid and the Global Alliance for Tax Justice. Well, what's the current state of religious belief and practice here in Australia? And how does it shape our attitude to politics, family, life and work? They're huge questions, but the Christian Research Association hasn't shied away from trying to answer them. The association has used a combination of data, including from the most recent census, to put together a picture of the believer and the unbeliever in our country. Its latest book is Life, Ethics and Faith in Australian Society. Andrew West is speaking with one of the co-authors, the principal researcher at the association, the Reverend Dr. Philip Hughes.
There's about 25% of Australians who have no doubts about the existence of God, for example. There's another 25% of Australians who are not sure. Sometimes they believe with doubts. Then there's another 25% approximately who believe that there is some sort of higher being up there. And then there's those people who really don't know or don't believe at all.
And the numbers of Christians is about 61%. But of course, you say that includes people that you might describe as cultural Christians, not necessarily affirming or believing Christians.
About half of the population has some sort of belief, but it was 15% of the population who actually attend a church monthly or more often. Nearly 60% of Australians say that faith gives them some sort of values for living.
Now, which faiths are growing and which are receding?
Most of the faiths that are growing through immigration are experiencing further growth. So Buddhism, the fastest growing is in fact Sikhism. Hinduism is growing very rapidly. Islam is growing somewhat. And most of the Christian denominations are stable or in decline, with a few of them growing faster than the population growth.
In decline as a percentage, but not numerically. That's very interesting.
That's certainly true with some, yes. The population's growing faster, but and they're not quite keeping up with that, but still growing in numbers.
And Christian denominations that are growing and receding, the once mighty Church of England or the Anglicans, I think 40% of the population after World War II, now about 15 to 17%.
Yes, that's right. 17% of the population now, yes.
And who's growing among the Christian denominations?
The fastest growth is amongst the Oriental Orthodox denominations, such as the Coptic Orthodox and some of the other denominations that have their roots in the Middle East and are continuing to experience growth through immigration. But then there is some growth amongst the Seventh-day Adventists and the Baptists, but they too are growing through immigration. The Pentecostals have been holding their own just in terms of the population. They've been growing in numbers, but not in terms of percentage.
Let's talk about who is having children, because the way I read your report, Catholics, Anglicans, mainstream Protestants all have very similar sized families. In fact, the age of the big Catholic family, that appears to be over, a thing of the past.
Certainly the size of the Catholic family is now no larger than that of others in the population. But there are certainly some groups which are having much larger families. The standout is the Brethren, Latter-day Saints have very large families, Muslims do, and there's a tendency for the evangelical and Pentecostal churches to have larger families than some of the mainstream denominations, so the Baptists and the Churches of Christ and so on.
Do we know what the basis of this change in family growth is, particularly among the Catholics? I mean, a generation or so ago, you had your six and seven kids in a Catholic family and you put one in the priesthood if you were lucky, as in inverted commas. What's changed there, Philip?
Part of it, I think, is that Catholics are operating now very much more in terms of their personal conscience in relation to contraception and family size, rather than believing that all contraception is wrong, as has been the official teaching of the Church. Mm. We also have to take into account that a very large portion of the population are Catholic, but a comparatively few percentage of the Catholic are actually active within the Catholic Church and are thus maintaining some of the teachings and the ideas of the Church. There is a tendency that comes through the data that where there are high levels of church involvement, there is also larger families. And that goes back to the fact that a number of people who attend church attend because it affirms their values in the life of the family and in their focus of life on the family.
On premarital sex, most Catholics and Protestants, 55 to 60%, say it's okay versus 66% of the total population. So not a big gap there. So there has been some liberalisation on the questions of sex.
Yes, there has. It's interesting, however, that the population as a whole and attenders have moved the other way in relationship to extramarital sex. So while there's more liberalisation in terms of people living together before they're married, the population as a whole is less happy about people sharing partners after they're married.
And would that apply equally to those who support same-sex relationships?
I think it does. I think there's been some significant changes in attitudes there. Homosexual relationships are seen as being a form of committed relationship. Mm. There are many who feel that promiscuity in that area is unacceptable.
Finally, you alluded to this earlier on the question of political views. Those who attend church and other religious institutions more regularly, they're more inclined to support higher taxes and public spending. Very similar, by the way, to a study in the UK.
That's right. Yes, even though they will vote for the political parties that don't want so much tax and want smaller government. Mm.
What accounts for that seemingly contradictory position? That you like the Labour Party's welfare policies, but you don't vote for them?
Again, I think that the overriding factor for many is the importance of family life. That's part of the reason why they're in the church, why they maintain their involvement in church life. And they vote for the parties which they see as endorsing the traditional structures of family life. And other things then become secondary in their voting intentions.
That's Dr. Philip Hughes, the Reverend Dr. Philip Hughes, who's the co-author of Life, Ethics and Faith in Australian Society, speaking with Andrew West. Philip Hughes is from the Christian Research Association. Well, that's about it for the program in this episode. If you want to go to our website, you can go to the Religion and Ethics Report homepage on the RN website and download all of the stories here. You can leave a comment if you want to make one. Thanks to producer Scott Spark and to technical producer Luke Purse. And now it's Drive with Waleed. Waleed, how are you?
Hey, Nolan. Well, I want to try something. I might just sit here in silence until the news and just see how you feel about it.
Is that how well the promo's gone?
Well, no. It's a serious sociological experiment. All right, you ready?
I think Stairway to Heaven will start.
See, we can't do it, can we?
No, I can't.
We can't deal with it. Right, now, I have it now on good authority that if we were told to sit in a room for 15 minutes and just do nothing and just be alone with our thoughts, about half of us would rather give ourselves electric shocks than have to do that.
I was thinking of razor blade cuts on my arm, something like that.
Well, maybe. That's the next phase of the experiment, I think, Noel. It's nice of you to volunteer. It's very generous of you. Can you believe that? We are that incapable of being alone with our thoughts that we would rather a negative experience like that.
Well, I've got to say that I was taught to meditate once, and I still do it on occasion when I feel the need to crawl up the wall.
And how do you go?
Well, I can usually manage 5 or 6 minutes before I feel that urge to start self-harming.
Before you have to administer electric shocks?
That's right.
Isn't it amazing? Anyway, so this is a study. We're going to have a look at that in our research field part of the program. You know who would have been administering electric shocks to themselves if they could? Brazilian football fans.
It was a terrible defeat, wasn't it?
It was actually ghoulish. It was horrible to watch. I felt almost sick watching it. And a nation is in mourning. So we'll see if we can make any sense of that after the news on Drive. See you then.